All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Sound, so I'm a little bit late, guys. The missus needed to fold the clothes then and there. My bad. She's walking the dog, I can't complain too much, man.
Bet you were like sweating with anxiety, wanting to get on the pod, and she just started like folding clothes.
No, because every time I say I'm going to come on, I'm like, I'll probably end up waiting 10, 15. So she thinks she's got loads of time. I'm like, come on, man. Fucking hurry up.
Not in the Westerns gym.
Mate, don't worry about me.
What I percent is that side at?
Enough percent. That's how much it is.
Just loosens him up. He'd be going down a YouTube rabbit hole after two of those.
Mate, after half of one, I'm gonna keep another tab open right now, man. Fuck it. Well, let's just get on with it. I don't want to like spoil the convo like right now.
Keep that energy high, innit? All right, welcome to episode number 39 of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I am joined by James Allen and Liam Flynn yet again. And we actually have a special guest on the show today, an ex-Manchester United Academy player who was with the club from the age of 6 until the age of 16 and played with some huge players currently plying their trade in the Premier League. He also had stints at Stoke and Warrington FC and then later went on to play college ball over here in the US. So Nicholas Jackson, welcome to the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Gentlemen, thanks for having me on.
Lovely to have you, mate. So usually what we do is, I don't know if you've listened to a few of our pods. I think you might have listened to last week's just before we got you on. But we usually start off with something we call the preamble ramble. So it's going to be based on football managers today. So Neil Warnock last week broke the record for the most games managed in English professional football when his Middlesbrough side lost 3-1 to Luton in his 1,602nd game in charge, which is quite remarkable. Unfortunately, just 4 days later, he was sacked after a 1-1 draw to West Bromwich Albion. So who'd be a football manager? This week, Warnock has been particularly active with the media following his dismissal, and he was asked to rank his top five Premier League managers of all time. Results may not surprise you, but the order in which he has chosen the coaches may. So what do we think of this? Nick, I'm going to give you first dibs. Can you? So basically, number one was Arsene Wenger. Number two was Pep Guardiola. Number three was Jurgen Klopp. Four was Fergie. And five was Jose Mourinho. So what do you make of that order?
Well, I'm going to go and say Arsene Wenger number one was pretty bold, but I kind of like the fact that he's gone with Arsene Wenger for a couple of points. Second point, Alex Ferguson number four, I'd have to put him second. I'd say that's pretty harsh. But I like the fact that he's gone with Arsene Wenger as number one, simply because I think the main difference between what he did at Arsenal and all the other guys is the budget that he worked on. He was picking out players. In the 90s, he picked up Will Todd for $500,000. You know, he plucked Thierry Henry from France for about 11, Petit. Some of the guys that he got playing there were unbelievable. So I think from a pure scouting coach point of view, I think he could pick a player probably better than anyone. Did it on a shoestring budget, and especially when they moved to the Emirates, he was getting them into fourth place, third place with properly shit players. So I think all the other managers had big purse strings. I think what he did for the Premier League in terms of changing the diets of the players, the professionalism that he put into the sport, and then also did it on a shoestring for, I don't know, 20 years was pretty impressive.
I think that's a great number one. You can't disagree with that, what you just laid out there. I mean, Dennis Bergkamp was €11 million. That was how much he cost. So that is nothing for the quality that he brought to the Premier League, was it?
Exactly. No, I agree. I think most managers, I'm not too sure if they can see talent from like 15 years on above. I think that's what Arsene Wenger had in abundance, to be honest. I think Sir Alex Ferguson, Mourinho, I think they're masters in sort of man management skills and getting the best out of the teams that they've, I don't know, produced or whatever. But I think that's their skill. I think Wenger was first and foremost a coach, and he could really spot talent really, really quickly. So I think some of the people that he got out of, or the players that he got out of France and around the world were absolutely great.
And Jim, me and you are massive Ferguson fans. What do you make of him being fourth on that list?
You know what? I was going to come in like, oh yeah, nothing wrong with Warnock's opinion, and then try and like big up the list and all that. But I didn't really consider the financial aspect that you've just outlined there and all the different facts. Welcome to the pod, Nick. By the way, that was absolutely smashing it, man.
he's done this before, isn't he?
It's downhill from here.
That logic is really difficult to argue with. And how detached you are from your own involvement with Manchester United is like impressive. I expected you to be like Alex Ferguson, give us some like, no, this is why, some like personal reason, but that you just like broke it down in a rational way. Again, with less of that insight, I would have to choose Ferguson against all the rest of them. I know he spent a lot of money, and I know he had a better infrastructure at United than Wenger did. But I'm just thinking purely in terms of Premier League's won, and obviously all that dramatic Champions League stuff. Like his trophy cabinet for me speaks like volumes in it, and I don't know if you could put Klopp ahead of him even on Warnock's list, man. What do you think about that? That's a bit left field, isn't it? Really.
I mean, Wenger and Ferguson built empires at their clubs. They built empires, man. You know what I mean? These guys were like leading like every aspect to their club. You know, down from the academy, all the way up to the first team transfers when they were buying high-profile stars, and they managed these high-profile stars throughout their careers. And I think me and you, Nick, we were talking about Manchester United have brought through an academy graduate every year since, what did you say, 1967 or something?
I think it's pre-World War II. I can't remember. I swear it's like 1945 or 44. They've had an academy graduate in their matchday squad.
That is incredible. Incredible. And that shows you that how he continued that dynasty on, you know, when he took over in sort of what, 1985 or whatever it was. But Flynn, you've actually done some pretty good research on these managers, which kind of like solidifies some of our opinions. Obviously, the Ferguson one's pretty incredible. So can you reel off some of that data that you looked at?
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought, you know, what better way to see if Warnock's right or wrong than by just getting all the hard facts, all the numbers. So I'll run through them for you. And let's see if he was right or wrong. So we'll start with Wenger. Now, I've chosen four criteria for each manager. First one is their time in the Premiership. So how many seasons were they there? Next one is how many times did they win the Premiership? Third one is how many trophies. So we'll start with Wenger. 22 years, he was in the Premiership. He won three times. He's got a total of 14 trophies, that's 7 FA Cups and 7 Community Shields. And he managed 828 matches and he saw 476 wins. That's 57.5% win rate. So what do we make of that there, guys?
Good stats, mate. Come on, longevity.
That's longevity. It's pretty FA Cup heavy, though, that is, isn't it? It's pretty FA Cup heavy. How many Prem wins? Only three wins in 22.
Just three, yeah.
What I would say about Arsene Wenger is it's the style of football that we eulogise now in modern football with Pep's Barcelona or what he's done at Man City or the tiki-taka style that everyone sort of is synonymous with good football. He was the first coach or continental coach that brought that to the UK. And I think everyone sort of changed their game around what Wenger did with that Arsenal team in the 90s. And then obviously with Henry and those, that Invincible team as well, he brought that style to the Premier League and was successful with it.
To be fair, should we just move on?
We've got four more to take a look at.
That's all right, isn't it?
We'll run through Guardiola at least. So let me run this by you. So he's had, he was there for five seasons. He won three times. 7 trophies, so that's 50% of Wenger's there. Out of those 7, it was 1 FA Cup, 4 EFL Cups, and 2 Community Shields. And he managed 201 matches, and he got 147 wins. That's 73.1%. So is that enough to be in second place? What do we reckon?
I mean, if he carries on that trajectory, absolutely. Like, what he's done in such a short amount of time is, like, unbelievable, really. But as you say, he's got the resource. He had the resources, like, there for him when he came in the club. He didn't really need to build anything. He's had all this money to spend. The geezer had, like, 300 million to spend on, like, on wing-backs. Do you know what I mean? Like, this guy had resources that no other coach has ever had in the history of the Premier League. That's the only criticism I would have of him being high in that table. I'd probably put him fifth in that list, to be honest. I'd probably put him last in that list at the minute. And I'm not sure if Jose Mourinho should even be in that top five.
Wait, one second, man. Just one thing about Guardiola. Look at the success and the periods that he's spent at each top club that he's been at. He seems like a man who... he searches for stimulus all the time. When things are getting stale, it seems to me like he's like, bang, where's the next A-class job I can go to? Where, as you say, you're going to have the most resources. But I think it's incredible that he's able to impress his philosophy onto so many different groups. I mean, maybe not a Barca because they've got that style kind of bred into them, but like going to Bayern, do you know what I mean? That's a pretty impressive thing, man.
All right, so yeah, we'll move this on swiftly then, but just Flynn, reel off these Ferguson stats for me, please.
Okay, yeah. Ferguson had 21 seasons. He won 13 times, 25 trophies. So that's 5 FA Cups, 4 Football League Cups, 10 Community Shields, 2 Champions League, 1 Euro Winners Cup, 1 Euro Super Cup, 1 Intercontinental Cup, and 1 Club World Cup. Matches managed, 810. Wins 528, so that's 65.2%.
Sold, finished. That's it. We're done. We'll move straight into the footy talk. Obviously, we'll get Nick's opinion on the Manchester derby. We'll do a little review of that. Prem roundup. We might sack off. Yeah, we won't talk about that too much. But we'll just focus on the Manchester derby for now. What did you make of that, Nick?
Ah, terrible. Absolutely awful.
Is that it?
really bad. there's not really many words to sum it up. Like after 4-0 at Liverpool, I was hoping that we'd just try. You know, like it just looked like we were sort of a League Two team that had been drawn against Man City in the FA Cup third round, and we just sort of set up to go, right, we're going to lose this game, but just please don't slap us 6-0. Yeah, just probably one of the most one-sided derbies I've ever seen in my whole life.
I got a question for you, man, because I'm confused on the outside, not being a Man United fan. For me, they look like they're in a good place overall. All right, they might not have been like, you know, top three, top two, or even competitive in the games against Liverpool and City, but they're still racking up wins. Ronaldo's still scoring when he needs to. Against like the shit teams, they do look like capable of proper turning sides over. Is it frustration born out of expecting more, or are United actually slipping further back this season under Ole?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's honestly the latter. So if you look at some of the games, I think there was a game at the start of the season where Ronnie scored a last minute goal. I think it was Newcastle at home, and everyone was, you know, left the ground absolutely buzzing, singing Viva Ronaldo, and, you know, saying we're back, whatever. But if you look at those games against those lesser teams, we're kind of scrapping last-minute goals against them. Atalanta in the Champions League the other day, he scores the 90th minute equaliser. And it's not as if we're sort of blowing these, you know, these teams away and then coming unstuck against, you know, really top opposition like Liverpool and Man City. I feel like it's just quite disjointed, and we're almost stumbling through these types of Atalanta games or Newcastle games, losing Aston Villa at home 1-0. And it's just the manner of the performances against big teams where you think, wow, we're actually going backwards here than trying to close that gap. And it's like 3.5 years into Ollie's tenure now at Old Trafford. And it's like, you know, it should be getting to a stage where with the money that he's spent, I think it's 400 million that, you know, the players that he's got, we should be a lot better than what we are.
Do you think Ole's tactically equipped to deal with Manchester United right now? Because I think what you find is, against some, obviously you just outlined some of the results where against the sort of mid-table to lower table teams that they haven't done so well in. And I think he has got some decent results against those teams in the bottom half of the table. But I think when he comes up against a tactically astute manager such as Klopp, such as Guardiola, I think he's so lost. And I think a lot of the players have kind of voiced their kind of concerns about how much the quality of the tactical instruction that they're getting is, you know, is correct, basically. And I think we saw that once again with him setting up in that 5-3-2 that he did. Obviously, you got Super McFred in the middle again that he seems to love. Do you know what I mean? He can't seem to veer away from them pair in the middle. And I just felt it was a bit of a nightmare for him. And obviously, City, I think they were just like, they were so happy just playing the way they usually do. And I don't think United really laid a glove on him. What do you make of this kind of like half press that Ole seems to do? He doesn't quite do a high press. It's kind of like a half press where like they kind of, I can't really explain it, because you need to either low block and respect the opposition and give them the ball, let them play in front, yeah. Or you need to full press and try and win it back as quickly as you can and hunt in packs. He doesn't seem to do either. It's kind of like somewhere in between. And City just like, all right, that's our bread and butter, man. We'll just pick through you all day long.
No, for sure. And I think against the Liverpool game at home, we did that sort of half press, half sit back into the shape, and they just popped it around us so easy. And it seems to me when I see Man United play against these top teams at home, the opposition seems to have so much time on the ball, so much space, where they can, no one seems to get anywhere near them. Or if they do, they go in like ones and twos. There just seems to be no structure. And I think we talked about it on our little, you know, sort of text messages before this podcast about the, I guess, the ineptitude of the actual backroom staff that he's got with the coaches. Obviously, Ollie's at the helm and he's the manager. He comes out to the press and whatever. But I think if you look at the assistant managers, the first team coaches and their history and who they've worked for and what they've done, this is all of their, it's the first time they've had a huge job. And I think these tactical holes are basically getting exploited by a lot better setups, a lot better teams with managers that have gone and won Champions Leagues and leagues and La Ligas, Premier Leagues, etc. That have, you know, that they've been successful. So, yeah, I think Ollie's getting the flak, but I think he's just got no support around him. You know, you've got like Michael Carrick, first big job. You've got Richard Hartis as the first team coach. He should be a bit better than what he's doing. But I just think if you look at the whole setup with Ollie at the helm, I think there's just a lack of experience in the whole group of coaches, which obviously it shows in the performances, you know?
Yeah, and we spoke about that kind of the nepotism involved in football, in sort of like giving jobs to your mates kind of thing that's been sort of ever present for such a long time, ever since the sort of inception of the Premier League, really. Giving your jobs to your best buddies and people that have got long-standing sort of reputations already in the Premier League, getting big opportunities. And obviously, we're starting to see that with some of the managers that are getting the jobs that you think, all right, perhaps managers that have been there and done it in the Championship and they've been plying their trade for a while, they've learned their trade in the Championship. You've got Frank Lampard, who obviously failed at Chelsea. He's now got his another opportunity in Norwich. So it's kind of like, all right, we'll wipe that slate clean. It's fine. That didn't happen. You know what I mean? That part of your managerial history didn't happen. Here's a new job at Norwich. All right, fair enough. They're down there and they're going to get relegated. But it's kind of like, at least it's another opportunity for him. And then Steven Gerrard, he's gone to Rangers, where I could go to Rangers and probably do a good job there. All right, he's been successful there. He's, you know, he's won the league with them. But once again, he's not going to get his big job at Liverpool just yet, because Klopp's probably going to be there for another 15 years or until he doesn't want the job. So he's probably thinking, all right, Aston Villa's a good opportunity for me. So both of those managers, where do you see their kind of future with those clubs? Are they using them as a stepping stone to get back to what the jobs that they really want?
On a side note, I wonder if we're going to see like the next generation of managers that we sort of grew up watching as like our idols and legends, like Lampard, Gerrard, Jerry Barton, who's now managing, and they're just going to do the merry-go-round of what we've been seeing with David Moyes, Steve Bruce, and that's just the new generation. And they have two seasons of mediocrity at like Aston Villa, and they go to the next team. I wonder if that's going to happen. But so yeah, Steven Gerrard at Aston Villa, do I think it's a stepping stone for his career? I mean, he went to Rangers, right, and he won the league. I think, were they, he stopped them winning their 10th, didn't he? I think that was quite a big achievement.
He stopped Celtic winning the 10th straight. Yeah.
The bastard. Absolutely. Bastard, man.
That was a good start for him. Aston Villa is a tricky job, I think, as well. I think that's one of those, I can't remember the last minute manager that did well. I think, what was the Irish guy that was doing well? He got them into like fifth.
Martin O'Neill.
Exactly, yeah. Martin O'Neill. That's when I remember Aston Villa being a good team under him. I can't remember any other managers doing that well after that. And I think the fans as well, the fans at Villa, if it starts going the wrong way, they kind of turn on the manager quite quickly. They expect quite a lot there. So I think it's a really good opportunity for him. I hope he does well. Obviously, it's a lot different to managing in the SPL. Premier League is absolutely ruthless. So I'm kind of intrigued as to see what kind of manager Gerrard is. I don't really pay attention too much to the Scottish League, but I'm not too sure. And yeah, I don't know. He's always going to be linked to the Liverpool job, right? I think Klopp's got 2.5 years left in his contract. He's just signed a 2.5 year deal at Aston Villa. I think in an ideal world, he'll get Villa to like 10th, 9th, maybe have a couple of good seasons and maybe get the Liverpool job. So yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it's a stepping stone.
Is that good enough for Liverpool though, after what Klopp's done there? Like, think about what he did at Dortmund before that, like electrified the Champions League with them. Could have picked most jobs in the world. He's come to Liverpool, ended their title drought with some amazing football. Like, look what Firmino, Salah, Mane are doing. And it's just like, peak right now. Liverpool are a peak team. I don't know if, like, Gerrard, as you say, it's basically limited managerial experience, and it being in Scotland, one or two teams are going to win it. There's, like, not that same level of intense challenge as there is in the Premier League. Yeah, obviously, he's a Liverpool legend, captain for a long time, won the Champions League, leader of men, all-time done. That's not under review. But that would be a step back, wouldn't it? Unless they start tumbling down the table under Klopp. But I don't see that, man. Do you know what I mean? Klopp's just a... He's just on top of things. It's him or Pep or now even Tommy Tuchel, man. So it's tough. It's tough to see where they go after Klopp, even if it is Gerrard.
I definitely agree. I think those types of managers like Klopp, Pep, they're so intense. The only way that I could see him ever leaving is that they actually take a step away. So, like, he was at Borussia Dortmund and he was like, I need some time out. And when Pep left Barcelona, he said, I need some time out because they're so intense. That could be the only way that I could see Gerrard getting a job at Liverpool after 2.5 years. But yeah, I agree with you. Like, I think Klopp's building a bit of a dynasty there that he's unreplaceable.
Yeah, Sam. Either of us fine. Is Bissett still... Bissett, can you hear us, man?
Yeah, no, I got you. I was... fucking Zoom were like, I'm gonna shut this down in 10 minutes unless you upgrade. So I had to quickly dip off and get my credit card, man.
Oh my God. That is commitment to the court. Watch this good connection, man. Be absolutely perfect now. Fuckers, man.
Once they've teethed some dollars off you, you're gonna be all right, man.
A lot of pressure, this, isn't it?
And that countdown. No.
What do you think Gerrard is actually like as a manager? I'd be intrigued to...
I reckon he's an absolute dickhead, mate, to be honest.
Yeah, I'd have to go along with that, man.
If I was a player, right, and he was pissing me off, I'd just bring up that slip against Chelsea all the time, mate.
Yeah, but look at what he's done in, like, that 2005 Champions League campaign. That is the stuff legends are made of, man. Like, he did it time and time again. Like, he may not have won the league and it was like his crucial era, but I mean, he was a ridiculous player, man. There were so many. He should have went to Chelsea when he had the chance, man. He would have had like 6 or 7 league titles, man.
Right, so we'll move straight into your footballing career, Nick, and sort of like over your teams you played for, what position you played, you know, who your idols were growing up and why is it Cristiano Ronaldo?
Yeah, my career was brief, but I managed to play with some okay people. What do you want to know? Ask us some questions.
So what position did you play?
I was a centre midfielder until I got to like 16, 17, and then I got moved back to right back, then eventually the bench, and then showing the door from there, really. So that's like the standard downgrade I was like really good until the age of like 15, I think. Then puberty struck and everyone just started getting really strong and quick. And
you think that you were sort of head and shoulders above players based down to your physicality more than anything?
No, I was never head and shoulders above anyone, but no, I was always quite a technical footballer. And then when people got stronger and quicker than me, I was sort of left in the prepubescent stage, and yeah, people started running quicker.
Okay, so the other way around.
I was the other way around. Yeah.
And so who are your sort of like main idols growing up? So who is the sort of players that you looked at when you were playing centre midfield? Who were the players that were like, all right, I want to go and play like him? You know, he's my idol.
Yeah, sure. Like so at United, it was Scholesy. I think everyone loves Scholesy. I think that was everyone's favourite player. He was absolutely amazing. And then like, so maybe off-piste ones, people like Raquel May, if you remember him. I remember watching him.
Oh yeah,
Villa
Real.
I remember that very skilled player. He was...
Villa Real, Dan.
Yeah, he was just... he was magic. He was great. And I actually loved watching Veron. I was at his debut when he played against Fulham. I think it was like 2001. And we used to get tickets and I watched him play. And I remember my dad just like saying like, that's the best performance he's seen from Man United player in decades. He's absolutely unbelievable. And I think people like Nicky Butt have got like sound bites and quotes saying that he never thought he'd play for Man United again after Veron's first training session. I think he was a top player, but it didn't work out for him at United and in England. But yeah, those three, I remember growing up and thinking they were class. And obviously your standard ones like Zidane and people like that.
going to say that's so interesting what you just said, because Varane is often cited as one of those bad picks by Fergie. One of these players that you shouldn't, didn't belong in a United team, didn't belong anywhere near Scholes in the lads, man. That's so interesting to hear that, man.
Yeah, big, big flop. He did flop. You can't deny it. I think he came for big money as well. I think it was like 28 million, which was huge at the time. But yeah, unbelievable footballer. Just didn't fit into our style. I think he was brought in to try and push us over the line in the Champions League. And I think he had some really good performances. I think we got beat one year to Bayer Leverkusen in the semis. But he was top. He was absolutely top. I don't think him and Roy Keane could play together because I think they both took up the same position on the pitch. I think Keane wanted to sort of like marshal the back four, but I think Varane wanted to be that type of like Xabi Alonso quarterback style player. And I think they kind of took up each other's space, so it didn't really work. But yeah, top player.
And obviously, you played with some top talent yourself as well. When you were in the United Academy setup, I think Paul Pogba, you said, Jesse Lingard, Robert Morrison, Michael Keane, just name a few. So what do you think were the defining factors of success for those players? And how much of players' progression into the first team do you think is down to like luck?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think luck is the biggest factor in anyone's career, not just in football, just in any walk of life, huge chunks of luck. I think what's quite interesting, the players that you've named there, namely Michael Keane and Jesse Lingard. So we'll take Michael Keane. His brother, Will Keane, not sure if anyone knows that name. He plays for Wigan now, but he made his debut at 17. I think at the club at the time, people used to call him Baby Berbatov. He had like a silky first touch. He used to run around like Berbatov. He was just pure class. Played for England 16s all the way up to 21. But yeah, he made his debut against Blackburn. I think 2011, and almost scored. And I think literally maybe 3 months after that, he did his cruciate ligament in his left knee. And then that kicked off like 4 or 5 years of really horrible injuries for him. I think that culminated in him tearing his calf under Van Gaal in an FA Cup game against Shrewsbury away. He hit the post, he tore his calf. That weekend, Rashford scored. I think he scored a couple of goals against Arsenal in the Premier League, and Will Keane should have been starting that game. So when you talk about luck and sort of sliding door moments, that's just a perfect example of how that can basically, yeah, define the next couple of years of your career or define a career basically. But he was absolute top player that you don't really know. And Michael Keane, his twin brother, was absolutely awful. I'm sure he's not going to listen to this podcast, but he was absolutely terrible. Honestly, he's Bambi on ice. Didn't really grow into his body until he was 18. Didn't really play from like 15 to 18, but became a man in the reserves and had a couple of good loan spells. And then all of a sudden he's playing for Burnley in the Premier League and gets a £30 million move to Everton. But, you know, just a mere 5 years earlier, his brother was on the cusp of making it big. So yeah, when you talk about luck, it's a huge part in anyone's development, and especially in football.
Yeah, and you mentioned Rashford. I do remember when he first came onto the scene, obviously when Van Gaal was in charge, I think it was like a Europa League tie where basically United had no forwards. I don't think they had any attacking options. And he was 16. And I think, you know, they always go that, oh, he's still doing his GCSEs. So like they brought him on the scene up through the academy. And he got his big job, or he got his first break into the first team, just based on the fact that United didn't have any first team attackers available. So there's that big slice of luck that some players needed. And now obviously he's a sort of a mainstay in that first team, even though he's had a bit of a rocky 18 months, hasn't he? Maybe 12 months, Rashford. He hasn't been flying like he first was when he was first on the scene.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it was Midtjylland or some random team like that, but he scored 2 goals and he was like 16, 17 at the time. And then on the weekend, I'm pretty sure it was Arsenal in the Prem. And I think he scored a header. But yeah, Will Keane he should have been playing those games if he didn't pop his groin in the FA Cup and in the midweek, which is just crazy really to look back on. But yeah, I definitely agree. And then Jesse, the look, I think in his career, loads of those pictures have been shared of Jesse playing in the Knight Cup. I'm not too sure if you've seen it. I was playing right back. He's basically in between two Roma players. And he's like maybe 4 foot, and these guys are like, you know, 5'11". They look like men already. So he never had size. But I think him being at a club like Manchester United, they gave him that sort of time where they'd say, right, you've got loads of ability, We're going to wait until you're 21. We're going to give you contracts to basically nurture your talent, you know, fill you out a little bit and sort of take a punt on him to see if he can, I guess, grow physically. Now, if Jesse was a lesser team with maybe tighter budgets, or, you know, they don't have that resource or the fitness training schedules and coaches to put that time and effort into him, would he be a Premier League footballer right now? So yeah, it's another slice of luck, essentially.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, because I think in England, we've always come under criticism, especially from the sort of European footballing nations, that we put too much emphasis on the physical aspect of the game. So picking big, strong, quick players that get more opportunities in the academies than the sort of like technically adept players, such as in Spain. I think they put a lot more emphasis on that, don't they? I think there's a lot more exposure to players that would be in that sort of like mold, that sort of technical mold, being good technically on the ball, short passes, getting away from players in terms of using the ball, rather than just sort of like the kick and rush old school way of playing. So, I mean, I'm going to relate this to you as well. So, and how you sort of motivated yourself coming out of that, because you were saying that you were sort of one of those technically gifted players. So how did you kind of continue to motivate yourself? You know, as say, I think you were released when you were like 15, 16 from the United Academy. So you put so much sort of time and effort into this dream of playing one day for United. And you'd sort of built up all this sort of skill, all this technical skill in 10 years. So how did you sort of like motivate yourself to carry on playing after you wouldn't receive that initial professional contract?
Yeah, it was tough. I think, it's extremely tough, because basically it's like a decade of your life and you don't really live a normal life, you know. And if you're playing like a Sunday league team or whatever, you know, you still can go out with your mates, like you become a teenager, you still go to the gigs and you still maybe hang around the park, etc. You're basically like a little mini pro from the time that you sign forms with any sort of an academy. So you live a very structured life. So for them to that get ripped away from you, it's like your heart getting ripped out of your chest, you know. So it's really, really hard to take. And it's a weird time in your life anyway, you know, 16, going through like puberty, you got exams, like it's a lot of stress. For you go to like trials. So I went to like Fulham on trial, went to Aston Villa on trial, Everton, Leeds, Stoke, and they all said no except from Stoke. So you just basically you get this I guess false sense of self when you're like, you're a really good player, you play for Man United, you know, you're at the cusp of maybe a YTS or whatever it might be, and you get told that you're a good player for a decade, and then all of a sudden you've got five clubs saying no, we don't want you for whatever reason. It's a massive reality check and a big wake-up call, and a lot of people don't really respond to that or react well to it. Luckily, I got a YTS at Stoke, so it was okay. But yeah, it's a big reality check for sure.
And do you think professional clubs need to do a better job of preparing players for life outside of professional football? Because me and Jim, I think we've spoke about this earlier on in the early days of the podcast, that there is real no sort of plan in place for these 16-year-old kids that have put so much time and so much commitment and such big portions of their life into, right, I'm going to be a professional footballer, that it's very, very difficult to sort of like realign yourself into sort of like a sort of a normal life as such. So do you think that professional clubs should be doing better in terms of preparing kids that don't make it?
Yeah, definitely, 100%. And you are completely right. There is no sort of net. Once you fall out of the system, there is no there's no one there telling you like, okay, this is your options. You know, maybe you go to university or get a job, or maybe there's a route back into football. I think one of the things, looking back, I can't believe the amount of footballers who don't make it that don't go into like being a referee or something like that. There's no one there that will, because obviously we love sport, right? We love football. That's what we've grown up doing. And the amount of kids that fall out of that system that could still give a lot back to the game in terms of refereeing, or if it's, I think we spoke about analytics and sort of the data stuff that's coming out of football now, or whatever it might be to do with football, there could be loads of avenues that you could be funneling these kids in. But yeah, it's like a conveyor belt, and once you get kicked off it, you're on the scrap heap and you're like damaged goods, essentially. So yeah, it's pretty criminal, to be fair. They'll take, you know, 10, 15 years of your life. Yeah, they'll give you some great experiences, and you know, you'll do things that you'll never forget and that you can be proud of. But I think how quickly it's taken away from the ruthlessness of it. I think it takes a lot of people a long time to recover from that. And I think because they've got no support and there is no support networks and systems to get people sort of out of their funk, really. I think once you come out of that professional environment, a lot of kids fall into a depression, they maybe turn to crime or they go down the wrong path. And I think that's just because there's no support network around. So yeah, they definitely need to do more.
I think the FA could go as far as to make it mandatory for every Premier League club to have this kind of, you know, a post contract scheme built into their club where they have professionals that actively seek employment in the game for, say, 18 months after they don't receive that professional contract. They should have a specialist that's helping them, guide them into different paths into football. You know, I think that should be something that should be mandatory.
I would agree. And I think there's also a massive misconception as well that footballers are all stupid people and they, you know, that they're thick, whatever. And I think a lot of footballers don't have like qualifications and the credentials is because they're spending, you know, 90% of their time focusing on football. They don't care about GCSEs. They don't care about A-levels, not bothered about getting a degree. They're experts of their field from the time they're probably like 14, 15, you know, that's that they're spending all of their time concentrated on one particular thing. So how they can take that amount of your life away from you and then not give you any support to try and use your skill set in a sporting environment is criminal, I think, definitely.
And just moved it on. So a few years after that, I can't remember what age you said you were when you made the sort of the step to join the college system out here in the US. How old were you when you did that?
19.
Okay, so yeah, it was a couple of years after you received that the bad news regarding the contract situation at United. And then you obviously had you had that stint with the Stoke YTS and then Warrington FC, did you say you played for as well in between?
Yeah,
them?
that was in the Evo stick. That was fun.
So what was appealing about the college system out here in the US?
I think what was appealing about it at the time was that I was basically, I'm not too sure if you've ever seen an Evo stick game, you know, watched it.
I think I went to Stalybridge Celtic once.
Yes. Yeah. I played there. It's grim. It's absolutely grim. It's you know, you're playing with like ex-pros or maybe guys that are like 30, 35, proper like veteran players that will just like absolutely clamp you in a tackle. They're not arsed, like really physical game, really bad pitches, not getting paid a lot of money either, like 50 quid a game, 60 quid a game, whatever it might be. Absolutely freezing cold. And I was just like, I've got a free ride to go to Florida to go and play college football for 4 years. So it's just a no-brainer to go and do it, you know. Still a really like professional setup. Got all like free boots, free gear, like free travel, decent standard. But just not as intense because it's sort of under that umbrella of you're a student athlete. So the student comes first. So it's not as it's not as sort of cutthroat, not as ruthless. You can still have an enjoyable time and sort of be, yeah. The reason why I basically chose it was I wanted to have sort of a college experience and a university experience while still playing football as well. So it was kind of like a nice compromise to try and have, or maybe recoup some of those years that I lost being so dedicated and so into it as an academy player, while still playing like decent college football, decent level, and getting a degree at the same time. So I kind of wish that there was maybe a system like that in England where they have maybe like a proper university system where boys that are released who, I don't know, maybe have some sort of entry exam can get in and maybe like they'll have like Loughborough versus Manchester University and that would be like some sort of game or league or something. I think that could work quite well, but they don't have it. So the next best option was to go to America.
And did you have any, sort of opportunities post-college soccer, into maybe an entry into the USL, USL2, because I know a guy that that was playing USL2, and it sounds like the kind of the same standard as the Evo stick, like not getting paid much. Yeah. Like, you know, you're having to travel sort of like 3 or 4 hours to get to a game. You don't get paid your mileage on your petrol and stuff like that. So it's really kind of like basically the same kind of level as the Evo stick. And that's the league, basically the league below the MLS.
Yeah.
So was there no pathway into, you know, academy systems in the US?
Yeah, there was. The Tampa Bay Rowdies, you know them?
Yes.
That was the team. That was the local team to us. We used to go and watch their... we actually played them. They beat us like 5-6-0 every year. They were decent. But I don't know. When I got to America, it was like I was 19. I was on a four-year course, graduated at 23. And I was kind of there to have more fun rather than focus on the football, to be perfectly honest with you. So that's what I did. That's what I chose. That was my path. So, but yeah, there is. If you're really, really... dedicated and that's the route you want to take, there was a guy that I played with called Tejada is his name. He plays for Tampa Bay Rowdies now. He got scouted after college, so there is a route you go on the what's it called, like the NFL draft, but you have like a soccer one. So you can enter into that, but yeah, it's not something that I ever did, but if you wanted to do it, you could do it.
I'm bowled over by how much that's affected my opinion of American football. I never thought I'd emerge from this thinking Premier League are a bunch of wankers, man. We need to do how the Yanks are doing it. Do you know what I mean? I never thought that was going to happen. But that is heartbreaking, man. Like, we have spoke about it before on the podcast, but to hear it from the horse's mouth is like, it's almost chilling. You know, from the time you're 12, 11... all through your pubescent stage where your hormones are firing off, like all that, as you say, you've encapsulated the lot, man. Exams, like stress, like school stuff, trying not to get pissed every weekend when everyone else is getting pissed every weekend. And then being as dedicated as you can possibly be, then all of a sudden the shit kid on the team grows to 6 foot tall and he's blasting past you in sprints. It's like, where's the logic in that, man? Like, what are you supposed to do to combat that? It's like luck of the draw, but you seem quite at ease with it now. I know. I hope you are, man, because that ruthless.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think it's quite easy to have a lot of resentment. And that's not my personality, you know. I always thought it was a bit strange anyway that I played football to a high level. I didn't really talk about it too much at school. Like, I don't know, that was my thing and that's what I was sort of good at. But I never really took it too seriously. I was always had like a pretty level head on my shoulders and was told pretty early from my dad that, you know, 1% of people make it. It just so turns out that maybe 6-7 people in that squad are like millionaires and playing the Premier League, which is rare. But I can't take away like some of the experience that I had, like playing in the Milk Cup in Ireland with like, you know, people like Makeda. Do you remember Makeda, who scored that goal against Aston Villa with Makeda? Yeah. That guy, yeah, he was on the team. Like,
well, he's
like
a bit of a Blues legend, he was. Yeah, he played for Birmingham, isn't he?
Well, he's way down, on his way down to the Blues. Scrap heap, mate.
I mean, yeah, so like winning the Milk Cup, even though I didn't play that much in that tournament, to be perfectly honest, I was on the bench for most of those games. But just stuff like that, like going away on tour with Man United when you're 15, you think you're the dog's bollocks, so it's cool. But yeah, it's a mad way to grow up, definitely being a part and attached to a football club and going through that system. But no, I always feel kind of lucky in a sense that my career, I can barely call it a career to be fair, but my sort of football experience got chopped at like 18, 19, because I feel more sorry for the people that get those pro contracts and they start making loads of money and they've basically made it. You know, they're 21, they're getting paid £1 million a year. And then by the time they're 23, they're playing with me five-a-side in Manchester somewhere in a car park, which has actually genuinely happened. You know, there's a guy called Larnell Cole who's in that team. He was part of the FA Youth Cup. He was a great player. He was a right winger. He got sold to Fulham. He was on like 15 grand a week at Fulham. And then, 25 years old, he was playing with me in a car park. So I can't even imagine like what those type of people go through where you're like, you've actually genuinely made it at a Premier League club. You're on loads of money. And then like 3 years later, you are literally, you know, a feather dust sort of, no one cares about you on the scrap heap. It's just nuts. It's the most ruthless game in the world.
Yeah, it's fucking nuts. And it's even worse. I want to compare it to the NFL because it's even worse in the NFL because that can happen in a week. Like literally, that if they don't want you, they cut you. So I think it's the ruthless world of sports, isn't it, really?
100%. I agree.
Barmy Flynn, did you have a question?
I didn't have a question. I just wanted to say thanks for sharing that with us. And I think that's going to open a lot of people's eyes. I had no idea it could be quite that cutthroat. And I agree with what you said. It sounds criminal. I mean, you were a child. Yeah. Yeah. So, like, and I'd like to echo Jim, like I know you quite well now, and you are pretty well put together, well adjusted man, and I think you should be proud of yourself for that.
Thanks, Lou.
That's all right.
I'm feeling so emotional. A Western and a half in and a life story. I need to go and have a lie down, man. One last question before we move on to the five things. Did you spend much time with Ravel Morrison?
Yeah. So, yeah, he was part of that group. I remember Ravel was always like a naughty kid, crazy kid. From when he was like 7 years old, like just one of those like street inner city kids that it was a proper like street footballer would. Do you know when you're like 7 years old and football's just nice and you're like, it should be like that. He would just be the one just like effing and jeffing. And like just being an absolute, do you know what I mean? It's just like, wow, like this guy's absolutely, he's tapped basically, he's absolutely nuts. But just what a football, like he really kicked on when he was about 14, 15. He started training with the first team. And yeah, there were stories where I think the first session he had with the first team, obviously the story sort of trickled back to us. He just like megged Vidic twice. And that was that team where we just won the Champions League. We'd done those three Premier League titles back to back, like first team to do that. And he's just gone in as a 15-year-old and he's just megged Vidic twice. And yeah, it's just an absolute unbelievable footballer. But the stories that would come back, he'd train with the first team. I think by this point, he'd left school. He'd do his days training with the first team in the daytime, but then he'd be rolling around with people from like inner city Manchester. And I think his car got caught with like an ounce of weed in it with some, I think there was some sort of guns there. There was some, like, he'd had some beef with his girlfriend at the time. He had like witness intimidation charge against him. He was just an absolute nutcase. Like, yeah, if he had my sort of head and I had his football ability, we'd be in the Premier League now.
Oh my God. That is lovely.
Smashing it.
That's really life though. And that's so frustrating. He's an absolute head case. Your mentality is tailor-made to go for the system. Keep a level head. Your dad's giving you good advice. And then he's like baller of the year, but he's absolute schizo, man. That's mental.
He was schizo. But then if you like listen to Ravel Morrison podcast now, I think he did one recently with Rio Ferdinand. He's actually like an okay guy, do you know what I mean? But at that time, yeah, I just think he was just rolling with the wrong people, maybe didn't have like a great family network around him. I think he was living with his grandparents at the time. He used to get lifts in from the club. I think he's one of those people, if you left into his own devices, he'd just get into trouble really, really quickly. But yeah, it's a good player. He's still playing now. He's at Derby and he's still doing okay. He's in the Championship. But yeah, he should have been in the Prem. He should be playing for Man United, definitely. If Jesse Lingard's still there getting 100 grand a week, there's no reason why Ravel Morrison shouldn't have.
He's in mine and Jib's top five, the streets won't forget, players, I believe. Up there with like Adel Taarabt, JJ Okocha, so good they named him twice.
Yeah.
So he's up there. I think I feel sorry for him because I think he's a product of his environment. Like a lot of players that are sort of from working class areas of Manchester, of London, of Liverpool, that can't really escape the friends that they've been brought up with, even if they do go to the sort of like next level in terms of their footballing careers. They can't escape that upbringing that they've had and all that sort of, all that bad advice goes with them. Do you know what I mean? It's very difficult to shake off, don't you think?
Yeah, 100%. It's a really good point for sure. It definitely shaped him. But I think there's a reason why lots of professional footballers come from underprivileged situations, because that's their avenue out of that. So the fact that maybe it took him till he was late 20s to realise it just went over his head, didn't it? He should have really, the ball should have dropped when he was like 18 and Fergie was like saying, look, like you're literally going to get sold to West Ham if you don't like sharpen up. Because that's, don't get me wrong, he's still a millionaire at the game. I don't feel sorry for him one bit. He's still in the Championship. He's probably getting paid 10, 15 grand a week. He's doing okay. Do you know what I mean? There's lots of footballers who have been in that position and are not getting any money out of it. So he's still done okay. But yeah, I think what could have been with him is he could have been a really, really top, top player. And yeah, once you get past the age of like 21, 22, especially after 25, it makes it just so hard for you to get those lost years back. I think he'll probably still end up in the Premiership. I think he'll try and get promoted with the Championship team, and I think he'll still do it eventually.
Well, I'd have him back at Blues any day of the week.
He's a good player.
You're not going to the Premiership, man.
He was class at Blues, man.
Remember that goal that he scored for West Ham?
He's probably scored a few. Which one?
against Tottenham away from the halfway line, just scooting past three, four players. Went, I think he chipped the keeper. Was it just good loads as, and loads of natural ability. He was a really good player.
Was it as good as the Hatton Ben Arthur one where he came from? Remember that one when he was playing for Newcastle? Who was that against? He was from like the halfway line.
Yeah.
He breezed past loads of players. Yeah, yeah.
Big goal, yeah, that was top.
He's in the top five streets, won't forget. let's do the five things you might have missed. So after that, to be honest, probably the best 40 minutes of this podcast, and it's going to be very, very difficult to beat for a long, long time. So, mm-hmm. Nick, that was absolutely fantastic. So, cheers for sharing that with us.
Absolutely, man. That was sick. I was happy just sitting there listening to you, mate. I was thinking, oh,
I was enamored, man. I was enamored just sitting here listening to you, man. It was absolutely brilliant. It really was. Right. So, five things you might miss. We'll reel these off quick. Then we've got the combat sports to talk about. Actually, I've got a few quiz questions for you as well. So that will lighten the mood a little bit. A few trivia questions, a few closest to. So you're each going to have a little guess on the trivia ones. And whoever gets the closest to is going to get a point. All right, and we're going to have a winner. So, but five things you might have missed first. So number one, the Tampa Bay Bucks fan who got given the football after Tom Brady's record 600th passing touchdown has received the gifts in exchange for politely giving it back after the organization reached out to him to retrieve the ball. I say fucking crooks, man. That'll be worth about $5 million in an auction in a few years. And they've gave him a fucking shirt. A couple of tickets to bloody, I don't know, Miami Dolphins versus Tampa Bay. Honestly, absolutely criminal. What do you reckon, Flynn? You've had a little word about this.
Yeah, I had a look into it. And you say crooks, but the fan in question, Byron Kennedy, he doesn't seem to mind that much. He said people are saying that I could have made $500,000 or something like that. But had I kept the ball, I wasn't going to sell it. I was just going to have it sat in my office at home. And so they gave him a few gifts, but also Brady himself has given him one Bitcoin, which is at an all-time high at the moment. It's like £50,000 or something. But the fan, Byron Kennedy, he really just wants to play a round of golf with Tom Brady. That's all he wants.
Fucking geezer needs to fucking get his head screwed on, man. Like, what is going on? Honestly, around the golf and a Bitcoin, mate. Like, that's pittance to what you could be getting. That's going to be worth dollar in like 20 years.
He might be
also
super rich.
Now, Tom Brady, if you're Tom Brady, are you going to go play golf with that guy? The guy who's just made that bad financial decision.
No chance.
You're like, nah, mate. He's going to walk into his house. There's going to be Tom Brady pictures all over the wall. Just the geezer standing there in his underpants, whipped cream on his nipples. It's not... Nah, allow it, man. Give him 3 more Bitcoin. Call it a loss, man. Fuck it.
All right, number two. Slap bang in the middle of the sports carnival, which has been the last few weeks with Premier League action, Champions League football, NFL, the Baseball World Series, and the return of basketball. Quiet and unassuming, the T20 Cricket World Cup taking place in Abu Dhabi is going about its steady business. With intriguing contests such as Namibia versus Scotland, Pakistan versus Afghanistan. So have we found the time in our busy schedules to check any of this out, boys?
I've jumped in. I saw some of the highlights from New Zealand and England, and it by all accounts, it was a banger.
Yeah, we got beat, and
England got beat, but they had a really, really strong start, and it looked like New Zealand weren't going to come back, but they did come back, and they've secured themselves a spot in the finals. Now, I was looking on a few fan forums to get the consensus from the fans, and apparently... Jimmy Neesham, or known as Neesh by the fans, he didn't get man of the match, but most people seem to agree that he won it for them. He brought New Zealand out of nowhere and back into the game by hitting 3 sixes and then paving the way for Daryl Mitchell, who did get man of the match, to bring it home. Also, Pakistan are also in the semi-finals. They've done really well so far with 4 wins in 4 games, but two of their star players, Mohammad Rizwan and Shoaib Malik, they've both got the flu. And it looks like they might not be able to play in the next game against Australia.
Oh, the flu. Got the flu, haven't they?
They've got the flu.
That flu, not coronavirus. Got the
Mate,
flu.
Do you remember when people used to call it the flu? Do you remember that?
Well, here's the thing. They had corona tests, both negative, but they're both really ill and they might not be able to play.
Well, Australia reached the final anyway, so that's it. It's all done and dusted now. So it's going to be Australia versus New Zealand in the final. That's going to be on Sunday. So an absolute thriller. I'm sure Jim, you and Jim will be checking it out. What about you, Nick?
Yeah, I am actually a big cricket fan, to be fair, but I've not watched any of this 2020, which is shocking.
It's because it's been at weird times, isn't it? It's like Dubai, isn't it? Like Abu Dhabi and also Oman and sort of those sort of states. So it's kind of like the times are a bit weird, isn't it? All right, so number three, high drama in the PSG women's team as a French midfielder Aminata Diallo has been arrested on allegations that she ordered two masked men to eliminate fellow teammate Kira Hamrui. So basically, the two masked men supposedly dragged Hamrui from her car and beat her legs at the order of Diallo. I mean, this is pretty shocking, to be honest. I mean, Nix, what's the furthest you've ever went to eliminate the competition of a rival squad player?
Nothing ever close to that. But I hope, I was saying to Flynn earlier, like, Ronaldo needs to get that guy's number and take out McFred for United. That'll go down well.
For sure, man. For sure.
The comparisons between that and the incident between Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan before the 94 Winter Olympics are shocking. Like, I don't know if you know about, like, Tanya Harding.
What the sports trivia, man? Like, where did you pull that out from?
Do you know about, you know, Blades of Glory? Yeah. They parodied it in that film. So this was something that actually happened.
Will Ferrell.
Tanya Harding told her husband, like, go fuck that bitch up, man. I need to go into the squad. And it actually happened as well. There's footage of the direct aftermath. But she recovered in time for the Olympics. Tanya Harding, I think, one of them finished, the one who got attacked finished second. She got silver. And the one who did the attack, Tanya Harding, she finished eighth. So I think she was just a bit whack at ice skating, like, to be honest. But yeah, it's I can't believe this has happened twice in reality. Do you know what I mean?
Shocking.
Did what happened to this Tanya Harding? Did she get arrested for this or what?
You know what? I watched a bit of a documentary. It was a long time ago now. There's been a lot of alcohol and drugs consumed since then. So I can't quite remember what happened. But I, Tanya, which is a film that they did about it. It's supposed to be proper sick. But for number four, the nation's sweetheart, Emma Raducanu, a favourite of the pod. She's chosen a new coach. She ditched her old coach, Andrew Robinson, after she won the US Open, the Judas, and has chosen Torben Belts to lead her from here. But almost as noteworthy as the news itself is the tone this move was reported with. To quote The Guardian, which I don't often do, Raducanu decided not to extend her temporary partnership with Andrew Robinson, and it was all underlined as well, just in case you were scared that Emma Raducanu could do something bad. Now, we were talking before about Naomi Osaka. She was like the queen of tennis, like on the cover of everything, on all the interviews, all that. She got on the wrong side of the media once. She decided not to play, and now you never hear anything. Emma Raducanu does something. She's a young girl. She's good looking. She's marketable. It's like they're trying to retroactively change the story about her already, and the story hasn't even begun. Do you know what I mean? It was a really fascinating incident of how the media builds up stars and implicitly tears them down later on.
Oh, fucking weasels, man. I hate them all, man, to be honest. It's just a shocker. You know what I mean? These young sports stars, 18, 19 years old, they're going through so much. They're getting all this fame thrown at them. They're getting all these, like, worm tongues in their ears, like, you know what I mean, trying to direct them in, you know, trying to put them down different paths. And then they have to deal with the media as well on top of all this. Absolute shocker, man. I bet you're glad you didn't become a superstar now, Nick, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. I guess it's like similar to how they reported Sterling, right?
Oh, what? Raheem Sterling on 200 grand a week for his mama house. What an absolutely horrible guy. Do you know what I mean? Like, what?
I literally always thought that Raheem Sterling had like five kids, but he doesn't. He has like one, I think he has one kid.
Oh, yeah, they made it out, like,
I was convinced that he had five kids, but he clearly doesn't. It's crazy.
You know, I think it's because he did balloons once and there was a video of him doing balloons. I don't want to, like, go down this route, but remember during the Euros, Harry Kane was on the front of every newspaper, every YouTube video I could look at. Raheem Sterling was one of the best players. He performed better than Kane, hands down, every game. You'd rather have Shaw on the front page than Harry Kane during the Euros. Raheem Sterling was consistently just booed by everyone, just criticised by everyone. It's just, there's some kind of weird angle there. I don't know what the criteria are for you to get love from the media.
But I do.
They definitely pick their favourites, so 100%, and it's fucking raving. But I'll move on to number five, and this is something I stumbled upon. and I had no prior knowledge to, but this guy, Gerald Stinstedt, died this week, age 91. He commentated on four World Cups for ITV between 1970 and 1982 before moving on to cover the Olympics for the BBC. He's one of the first to call out racist abuse on air during the 1978 Man U West Brom game. He also called the World Cup game in 1994 where Maradona scored, then stared into the nearest camera like a rabid dog and promptly tested positive for, quote, five variants of ephedrine. From the New York Times. So old Stinny was a bit of a legend, it sounds like. I never heard of his name before, but I wanted to give him a bit of a shout out because it sounds like he was a massive part of our footballing history.
Does anyone know this guy and can replicate his voice?
Nah, I ain't got a clue.
I can't. You probably know it, innit? If you hear it, you probably know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never ever heard his name before, but come on, four World Cups, even if it was like in the worst period of English football history, like, you know what I mean?
All right, so that'll be it for the five things you might miss. Should we crack on with the quiz?
Let's do it.
Oh, yes, yes.
Are you ready? I've got three questions, and I was going to do a tiebreaker, but I've obviously forgot to do it, so I'll have to make that up on the spot or something. I don't know. So, yeah, three questions. One of them's a footy question. Two of them are footy questions, and one of them is a baseball question, so that's going to be interesting. See if you can get near that one. Just because. No, it's kind of like a closest to. They're like attendances or years. So whoever gets closest to is going to get a point, yeah.
Yeah, there's some bullshit, mate.
All right. Are you ready?
Yes.
Jim, you're going to like this first one.
I know.
So what was the attendance of the first ever FA Cup final between Wanderers and Royal Engineers in 1872, which was famously played at the Kennington Oval Cricket Ground? So what's the attendance? Jim, go first.
130,000.
Go on then, Nick.
Yeah, I think it's going to be in the hundreds, to be fair. I reckon 110.
I'm thinking 20,000.
Lynn gets the point. It was actually only 2,000.
What? What? No. What was it?
2,000, yeah. Apparently. I was the same as you. This is why I picked this question when I was looking through this. I was like, I expected it to be massive. And then when I saw it was only 2,000, I was like, what?
That's disappointing, isn't it? Where was everyone?
I'd be surprised that they could build a stadium that would hold 100,000 people in the 1800s.
It was all flat, though, wasn't it? It was all flat and chairs, and people didn't give a shit whether they could see the thing or not. So they could just stack and stack and stack. But they used to just throw up wooden arenas back in the day. They didn't give a fuck.
I guess people didn't really care about football, innit, back in 1872. Do you know what I mean? It still might have been sort of like an emerging sport. Because like, I guess they were all into like probably like more into rugby and cricket, obviously.
Mate, I'm fully. Can we move on to the next one, sharpish? Because we got
absolutely
that so wrong,
fuming, Jim is fuming. All right, so that's a 1-0 to Flynn. Earlier we spoke about Neil Warnock's longevity in his career as a football manager. I want to know, in which year did he take his first full managerial position? And you get an extra point if you can tell me which team it was. So what year did he take his first foray into football management as a full managerial position? Flynn, you got to go first because you won a lot.
I'm going to go for 68. It was in the year 68 and it was with Bolton.
Okay. Yeah. Go on, Nick.
I'm going to say 65. Well, I don't know. I haven't got a clue, to be fair. I really don't know. Halifax.
Yeah, and Jim?
I've got it on good authority that it was in 1981 with Wickham Wanderers.
Are you reading that off somewhere?
Mate, Jim got the fucking year spot on.
Fuck off.
Wow. 1980 to 1981 was his first club.
That is honest to God, yeah. I wish I could screen share. That was a guess.
And the team was Gainsborough Trinity. That was his first... team that he managed in 1980-1981 season. So,
to be fair, I'd say 81 is 81-82 season, isn't it? If we're being, it is,
you get the point either way, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right, fair enough, mate. Nice one. Should we move on to the next one?
All right, so the third one's going to be a baseball one. So, hopefully, I haven't got a tiebreaker, so we'll see what happens. The Baseball World Series culminated in a 4-2 Atlanta Braves win over the Houston Astros as they won their fourth World Series title and their first since 1995. So there's going to be a few points on the table for this one. I want to know, what was the first ever World Series encounter and who were the two teams involved? So when was the first World Series and who were the two teams involved? So we'll go Nick first.
World Series is what, baseball?
Yep. Yeah.
Baseball, I haven't got a clue.
It's their championship. So it's their championship game.
I don't know. I reckon the first one was like 52. And let's just go Red Sox versus, I don't know. I don't even know the teams. Someone in Florida.
Okay.
Jim. Love that. Love that. Okay. I've got an idea of the era. I'll go 1904.
Oh, wow.
And I think I'm going to rob one of Nick's answers and go, I'll say the Black Sox and the Yankees.
The Black Sox?
They were Black Sox. There's a Black Sox, aren't there? Is there a Black Sox?
No, there's White Sox and Red Sox.
Oh, all right, then I'll go with the White Sox.
But no Black Sox, son.
Maybe the Black Sox are the Yankees, and that's what I'm thinking. Yeah, I'll go the Yankees and the White Sox.
All right, so Yankees and the White Sox. Okay, go on, Flynn, in 1904, did you say?
Yeah.
Okay, go on then, Flynn.
I think I'm going to go with 1903.
And what teams?
And I'm going to go for, I'm the same as you guys, I don't really know many of the teams. Let's go with one of the Sox. Let's say the two Sox, the White Sox and the Red Sox.
Okay, so the answer was 1903.
Oh!
So Jim going ahead of you, Flynn, gave you the answer, really. And the two teams were, it was a Sox. It was the Red Sox.
Ah, you can't.
So what did you say? I think you said white, didn't you?
I said both, the Sox.
Oh, you can't okay.
Yeah, you're Soxing it up, aren't
you? You said the Sox versus the Sox. So I think it was the Boston Red Sox versus the Pittsburgh Pirates. So I think Flynn wins.
I smashed it.
Oh, guys. Good man, Flynn. Good Don't man. Congratulations.
I am quiz genius, man. Jim's
absolutely gutted.
Yeah, he's good. I can hear it in his voice, man. He's absolutely devastated, like.
Yeah, brave. Money to go, man. There's a family emergency in the other room, man. Might blow.
All right, should we do the combat sports then, son?
Yes. We'll start with the UFC, and their big shows are rarely boring, but UFC 268 was pretty intense from the off. I only caught the main card, so we'll go from there. So we'll start off with Justin Gaethje and Marco Chandler, and they went for three of the most intense rounds I've ever seen. Chandler came out, locked and loaded, spraying Agent Orange all over the place. That's a Vietnam War joke, if anyone doesn't get it. Nope. At first, he was in a low stance, trying to slide away from Gaethje's leg kicks, which are a weapon universally feared in the lightweight division. Even Khabib wasn't trying to eat too many of those, so that shows you how much damage they can inflict. Gaethje landed a few, but Chandler either avoided or absorbed them early on. Then he started letting bombs go, and he hurt Gaethje badly with big punches, then a jumping knee, then followed in to the cage, hands down, chest out, ready to close the show. And I think this was a pivotal moment in the fight, because Gaethje, back to the cage, he started ducking and swinging back. He cut and hurt Chandler. He chopped at the legs again and ended the round in full control and began to work his uppercut, which, as we come on to see, was a devastating weapon as well. This is the punch that he dropped Chandler with a minute and a half into the second round. It's a massive shot, straight expelliarmus on your back, son. Don't worry about it.
That's a Harry Potter reference. I got that one.
Yeah, mate, don't worry. Oh, they keep coming, mate. I keep slipping them in. You don't even know. All right. And Chandler did really well to get up, and he narrowly missed the left hook that was coming in behind that right uppercut on the way down. So he was pretty lucky there, but he swerved the follow-up, and then he grabbed hold of one of the most extended single legs I've ever seen, literally hands directly above his head, clasping around the back of the thigh, and basically held on for the end of the round. He never truly recovered from being hurt. Once he thought he had the fight won in the first round, he never got back to that place mentally or physically. And a mad suplex scramble aside, the rest of the fight was Gaethje just being the calculated pressure fighter that first appeared against Tony Ferguson that no one really thought existed. I mean, he came into the UFC, fought Michael Johnson, just about pulled out the win there, lost to Poirier, lost to Alvarez before he went to ONE FC. And, you know, this is a guy who's reached his next level. This is an animal who's been tamed to just the right degree. I think he should get the winner of Charles Oliveira versus Dustin Poirier. I think it's at the end of the year. Chandler was exhausted and battered, but managed to hear the final bell. Incredibly tough. But I feel it was his ego and not his ability that let him down here. He was spitting blood, waving Gaethje in, and taking his best shots clean to the face, but only just. There were several times where he wobbled pretty badly and then reset, and then it was as if something reminded him to stay on his feet. But by that point, technique was all the way gone out the window. Everything being perfect, he might still not have had enough to beat Gagey, who's never lost his composure amidst all that madness. There was also an eye poke in the second round. I don't know if you guys caught this. Mm-hmm. And the way the ref handled it was an absolute disgrace. If I was part of Gagey's team, I would be filing a complaint with the New York Athletic Commission straight up, man.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about that there, Jim. Just before I do, though, I agree with you. Amazing match. Me, personally, it was one of the best matchups I think I've ever seen. And I think you're right about Chandler's ego. In that third round, he just seemed intent on putting on a good show rather than trying to win anymore. He was literally just walking through Gagey's shots like he was the Terminator. And I tell you what, the lightweight division, it almost never fails to disappoint. I reckon you've nailed it as well with your prediction. Gagey's definitely taking on the winner of Poirier and Oliveira, 100%. But yeah, I just want to go back to the eye poke. So what I saw an accidental eye poke. And then I remember the ref calling a timeout and then letting them continue once Gagey seemed okay. So I just wanted to know, why is it disgusting?
Okay, so when someone gets poked in the eye, first of all, the eye poke came from Chandler kind of flapping with a left hook with his finger out, and it went across Gagey's right eye. Clear eye poke. And when you see Gagey turn away when he's on top in the fight, you know something's not quite right, not within the realm of the rules of the UFC. So he goes to the cage, he tells the ref, he just poked me in the eye. Now, at that point, and once the ref is like, believes him, because some fighters try and pull a fast one, but you have to give him the benefit of the doubt. The ref is supposed to give him 5 minutes. That is their allotted time after an accidental foul to recover if they want it. Now, rarely does it go the full 5 minutes, but the referee said to Justin Gagey, "Are you good?" And Justin Gagey said, "No, I'm not good. He just poked me in the fucking eye." And then the referee asked him again. He says, "Are you good?" And then you saw Gagey's ego kind of coming. He's like, "Yeah, I'm good." He's like, "I'm still good to fight." But even as he continued the fight and continued to win, he was still admonishing the referee for like, you shouldn't rush your fighter doing that. It doesn't matter. I think the referee became a spectator in that moment. I think he got dragged into the drama of it all. And I think he wanted to see him carry on for the fans and for himself and for the company and all that. But that's not his fucking job. His job is to safeguard the fighters. And he failed in that instance.
No, I was going to say, was he slightly worried, Gage, did you think, that the referee might call in the doctor to assess whether the fight could continue? Was that in the back of his mind?
To be honest with you, it's impossible to determine the extent of the damage once an eye poke goes in. Some, like Daniel Cormier versus Stipe Miocic in the trilogy fight, he got a poke in the eye and it was a balloon straight away, and he couldn't see out of it. And he still couldn't see out of it in the post-fight interview. And he said as much. You don't know if that's just a little scrape or a little poke. You don't know if you're going to be able to see in 30 seconds or a few minutes or a few hours. You might lose your sight entirely. Do you know what I mean? That's why you're supposed to be given ample time to recover. And he didn't get it, which is bullshit, man.
Does that include a big old kick in the bollocks as well? The 5 minutes.
Which sometimes happen, which they rarely acknowledge. Which they wear cups though, innit? Do you know what I mean? It's all right. No, you can't wear a cup on your eye. But onto the co-main event. And this is Jess still in the room now? Because she's going to be fuming about this.
Nah, she's gone. She knew this was coming up, so she's abruptly left.
All right, sweet. So Rose Namajunas defended her flyweight title in a rematch with the former champ, Zhang Weili. Rose ended that first fight in the first round with a beautiful head kick. But Zhang wasn't about to let that happen again. She was far more circumspect, using her movement on the outside, utilizing leg kicks just like Gagey. And she scored a strong takedown early on. She hurt Rose with a counter left hook in a second, but Rose nearly caught her slipping and flung up that same left high kick that she knocked her out with in the first fight. Zhang snatched her foot in midair and drove her down for another takedown. She did that several times, actually, which indicates to me that she focused on preventing that specific attack entirely during the camp. But then we saw yet again, while Rose is the champion, she stayed composed, she got up, then took Zhang down with an outside trip from the body lock. The pendulum swung back in the third, even striking exchanges, but Zhang finished that round on top with another takedown, impressively maintained her position until the end. But as the fight wore on, she definitely utilized those leg kicks less. She didn't abandon them completely, but there was a definite decrease, which was puzzling as Rose's thigh looked pretty sunburnt from the battering it was taking. And she wasn't moving the same, but she kept a good poker face. She carried on like feinting with her hand and launching long punches. And that's probably what edged at the fourth with the long right hands. And she definitely controlled the fifth with a takedown and top control for the last 4 minutes almost. And on balance and on reflection, I think that's what won her the fight, that fifth round, her decision to take her down and hold her there. Because that was probably the only round in the fight where you could say Rose clearly won that. And that, you know, 49-46 was a harsh scorecard from one of the judges. There was only one round in that for me.
Harsh to say the least, man. I think that was fucking highly egregious, to be honest, that 49-46 card.
Well, it's one round, isn't it? This is the thing. Like, it's hard to say. Like, early on, I thought Zhang Weili won the first two rounds, man. So then it's a question. If Rose clearly won the fifth, did she clearly win?
That's what I had. I had it 2-2 going into the fifth, and then clearly Rose won the fifth because of her ground control time. I couldn't believe that Zhang wasn't trying to get to her feet for the entirety of that last 4 minutes. I couldn't work it out.
No, it's not that, you know. It's like the only reason I know how tiring that is my limited experience with jiu-jitsu, man. And like, if you grappling is a high energy output type of thing, especially if you're on the bottom, and especially if the person on top of you has a good idea of where you're about to move, which is what like top level BJJ practitioners work on all the time. Now, Zhang Weili is no slouch yourself. You saw a transition in the first round where Rose tried to butterfly sweep her and she just jumped over the top and maintained that pressure. It looks to me like she's better from top position than she is from defending from the bottom. That might be a bit of a hole in her game, but I doubt she wasn't trying to get up. I think exhaustion, I think damage. I think she might have thought that she had the fight won. You don't know what a corner's telling her. You know, there's a lot of different factors there, man, but I don't think it's as simple as she wasn't trying to get up.
I think this one was a banger, an absolute banger from start to finish. And I can see both of you think the right woman won. I think so too. But I've been seeing a lot of talk online that there was some bias in that judge's decision, and I think you both agree. But what I want to ask you is, what do you think caused that? Why do you think there is a bias? Is it because she's a champ? Is it because she's from the US? What do you think?
There's always going to be, well, not always, but 95% of the time, there's going to be a hometown bias, in quotes, or the home fighter bias. The person who either the promotion or the fan base follows more than the other one. It's an ugly truth of combat sports. It's even more so in boxing, you know. And if we have any disagreement at all, which we don't, it would be over one round. So it's not a big deal, is it? It's not like nailed on either way. I don't think she was... The 49-46 seems like she was favoured, but you could also make a case for her getting one of those rounds. But the hometown decision is a nailed-on thing in combat sports. Don't let anyone tell you different. That shit happens on the regular. I'm just not sure it happened here. Do you know what I mean?
And I think bias, there is a bias towards the champ as well. I do think the champs get slight advantages in terms of, I think we've spoke about it before in boxing especially, and when, say somebody's doing a ground and pound to finish a fight, do the champs get that extra 2 or 3 seconds to recover than perhaps the contenders do? And I think you do see a lot of that in combat sports. What do you reckon, Jim?
No, absolutely, man. I mean, you see a lot in the UFC, guys who are on the bottom getting brain down punches on, and now you're thinking as a spectator, you're going, okay, probably time to step in about now. And the referees just seem to have, maybe hesitation isn't the right word, maybe they've earned that as champion, but at the end of the day, the contest is supposed to be adjudged fairly. I don't think one fighter should get precedence over the other because it's about their safety at the end of the day. Obviously, I enjoy watching them battering each other, but I don't want anyone to take home any permanent, as few permanent like consequences from the fight as possible, if at all possible, which I'm not sure if it is, which makes me feel conflicted about watching combat sports at all. But we'll move on to the main event. And it was another rematch between Kamaru Usman and Colby Covington. And again, Usman won the fight to retain his welterweight title. Colby was more restrained in this fight, but I thought there was something a little bit off about the way he was moving and the way he continuously looped his left hand. He's got a new trainer. I don't know if that's a hole in their regime or what, but I put him at a massive disadvantage again against Usman, who's famously become a serious puncher late in his career by doing the exact opposite, straightening his punches to the point where you can't see what's coming, the left or the right. And that was basically the story of the striking exchanges. Usman was more technical, more accurate. Colby waited for his time to rush in, but he still favoured volume over precision. And like Wei Li, Usman's right side guard was almost impervious to Colby's left high kicks. He tried them over and over again. No joy. Same with the takedowns. Colby tried them, but it just didn't work. And it's up for debate whether Colby actually broke Usman's 100% takedown defence record during the fight. Daniel Cormier said yes. Joe Rogan says no. I couldn't care less, to be honest with you. Even if Colby did officially take him down, he didn't do anything with it. And I don't want to sound like Colby was completely blown out of there, because he did have some moments of success, especially in the fourth and the fifth rounds. But the better work came from Usman throughout the entire fight. He cut and dropped Colby twice with left hooks in the second. He battered his body and jabbed his face to pieces all night. Basically, he never allowed Colby to keep his nose in front for more than a minute or so at a time. He was rightfully awarded the unanimous decision. And I'm starting to seriously wonder who would win out of Kamaru Usman and Georges St-Pierre. Mythical matchup status, man.
Speaking of Georges St-Pierre, GSP. So as many fans of the sport know, GSP is widely regarded as the best welterweight of all time. He's often mentioned as one of the greatest fighters of all time, period. His record stands at 26 wins to 2 losses. He held titles in 2 divisions. He held the records for most wins in title bouts. And he had the second longest combined title streak in UFC history, which was 2,204 days. So he was literally a champion for about 6 years in total. And during these reigns, he defended his titles 9 times. Now, after last weekend's matchup, UFC president Dana White now believes that Usman has overtaken GSP. He was reported as saying, "Usman, this guy, he's the best ever. He's the best welterweight of all time, and he is on his possible way to GOAT status." So I wanted to ask you, Jim, what's your thoughts on this? Is it too early to say something like this? Is Usman better than GSP, or is Dana just trying to hype him up?
Well, you've mentioned a few impressive stats there. 2,204 days, 6 years total. And he was a mainstay. He was one of the faces of the UFC for a long time. But I don't think you can discount, with a character like Dana White, the disagreement that they had late on in Georges St-Pierre's career. He came back, he fought Michael Bisping, became a 2-weight world champion, which is just another feather in his cap, you know what I mean? To be not the strongest middleweight champion, but you got to beat the champ to get the belt, ain't you? And he looked absolutely dominant in that fight. If I remember correctly, he overcame a bout of gastroarticulitis, I think. He had a really serious stomach problem going into that fight, still managed to overcome and choke Michael Bisping asleep. The reason I bring Dana White into it is because it's in his interest to promote the current champion as the guy, the best. It was the same with Khabib. It was the same with John Jones before his latest running with the law, man. I think they're just about done with him now. It's in the UFC's interest, in the promotion's interest, in his personal interest to promote Kamaru Usman as the number one guy. That's not to say that he wouldn't beat Georges St-Pierre, because I think that is an enticing fight. I really do. And Georges St-Pierre, one of his best weapons was his takedowns. And as we established just then, Kamaru Usman rarely, if ever, gets taken down. So I wonder what they could do on the feet. I think that'd be a fascinating fight. I won't be picking a winner here and now, though. I'll have to go back and watch a few fights, like. You know what I mean?
Just to go back to the takedown defense, UFC have officially stated that he wasn't taken down, as Covington didn't I forget the exact quote, but he didn't get proper ground control.
Yeah,
doesn't count.
Well, that's fair enough. And I can see the logic and I wouldn't necessarily disagree, but that's also tickling my conspiratorial fancy right there. It's a company move, and whether it's right or wrong, I'm definitely going to view that as a company move. But
They don't want any blotches, man, do they? They don't want any blotches on that fine-looking specimen that is Kamaru Usman, man.
That's what I'm telling you, man. But from the cage to the ring for our final fight review, and Saul Canelo Alvarez becomes the first super middleweight champion in history. Now, this division was only born in the 80s, so you can't be too gassed about it, but it's still pretty good. He won with an 11-round stoppage over Caleb Plant at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. And I actually had Plant up 4-2 after 6, but I was hanging out of my ass and viewing through a scratched eye. So forgive me if that seems outlandish. Plant was doing a great job of moving in both directions, leaning low away from Canelo's punches and basically being a slippery little fish while he still had the legs to carry him. But Canelo is the main man for a reason. He's one of the few boxers you see who consistently does the perfect thing at the perfect time. When Plant would duck off to the side, he would frame against his neck and bang on his body, and he didn't wait for ideal openings, knowing Plant wasn't going to present them with his style. Instead, he did what he did to Callum Smith. He hit anything he could reach with his gloves. Now, understandably, this war on Plant, who lasted until the penultimate round before, just as Sergey Kovalev did, he wilted. Now, you won't see many better finishers than Canelo. His instincts and his choices just compounded Plant's unraveling. I don't care who Canelo fights next. He's done enough for two careers already. Now it's just a question of how much more he can squeeze into his remaining years as a fighter. But don't forget, he's only 31 years old, man. Absolutely frightening.
I want to get your opinion on Caleb Plant first off. Did you expect the fight to be as close as it was going into the sort of championship rounds? Because I thought, I was flicking back between this and the Rose fight, the Rose and Zhang fight. So I was kind of like seeing little bits and bobs in the sort of first six, seven rounds. And what I saw was like Plant just kind of bouncing around the ring, really, not getting too close to Canelo, not really letting him get in any kind of momentum in the fight. Looked like he was boxing well, but wasn't really calling Canelo any trouble. So where have your estimations of Plant gone up? Did you think he fought well? Does he deserve more, say, title shots in the future? Obviously, he can't at the moment because Canelo is holding all the belts. But where does he go from here, Plant?
I didn't have that much exposure to Plant beforehand. I watched his fight against Uzkategui, and I watched him fight someone else. He went the distance both times anyway. And the one thing I can compliment Plant on is that he didn't let Canelo's presence alter his fighting style. He fought his own fight and he tried his best for as long as he could. But the thing, he just came up against a guy who had more tools than he did. You know, like Canelo can counterpunch, he can pressure fight, he can do all these little niche things like framing against the neck and hitting everything he can. He's just a more well-rounded fighter and significantly undersized in this fight. And he continuously has been at 168. Plant went up in my estimation just for being himself, and he can absolutely get another title in the future. It's just a matter of whether Canelo decides to stay at 168 or not.
And where does he go from here, Jim? Where does Canelo go from here? Does he move up, mix it up with the Russians, Bivol and Beterbiev, who hold the titles at light heavyweight? Because he smoked everybody in, what, three or four weight categories now? It's ridiculous. Does he do that? Does he move up? Because that would sort of like continue his legacy, like it needs continuing anyway, because he's just cementing himself as probably one of the best boxers in history anyway. Or does he sort of join the circus and set up some ridiculous fight with, say, Kamaru Usman, who we spoke about earlier, which I think has been suggested to Dana White, who incidentally was watching Canelo Plant on his laptop during the Rose-Zhang fight?
I think Canelo is one of the few fighters, along with Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury, who doesn't need these mad gimmick fights, these circus attractions. And, you know, I watch them, same as everyone else does. I'm not diminishing them on that level. But I can't see it. Canelo's a premier star, man. He's like 1, 2, 3 in the world in terms of marketability, in terms of actual ability. He's the man right now. So I can't see him getting involved in anything like that. In terms of his step up to 175, at 168, he already looks a bit too small for me, man. And, you know, you can only go so far up. Listen, I'm not going to hate on him for trying. If he goes up against Bivol, I think Bivol's a nightmare for him because he's not interested about entertaining. Do you know what I mean? I think Beterbiev, even though he's got a deserved reputation as a fearsome puncher with a 100% KO record, I think he presents a lot of openings for Canelo. I think Canelo's of the caliber where you can actually take strength and power out of the equation because he fought Gennady Golovkin twice. I know that was at middleweight, but you can't. He's got that experience and he's got that. You know, the way Michael Chandler had his ego let him down and it rushed him into bad decisions. I think Canelo's ego does the exact opposite. I think it makes him more circumspect and more focused and more attentive and more like tuning in on all the little details. Like Mayweather, man.
I was going to say, yeah, you took the word right out of my mouth. I was going to mention Mayweather. Doesn't care about putting on a show. All he cared about was getting that win.
But his style is naturally attractive. as well, which is Mayweather. You can't really say that about him. His persona became more like pro wrestler later on, even though his boxing skills were immense. They were more for like the hardcore fans. His persona was for the casuals, but his boxing style was for the hardcores. Canelo is ticking all boxes all the time. And I think he probably will go up to 175. He just seems like that kind of guy. He's already done it. He already beat Sergey Kovalev, who's just, you know, one of the more dominant champions of recent years in that division. So I can't see him being overwhelmed by other people's size.
Scary geezer.
I know, but we'll just look ahead quickly to next weekend for the boxing and the UFC. Jaime Munguia versus Gabriel Rosado in a 12-rounder for a little trinket belt. Expect that one to turn bloody because Rosado's face is like a paper mache. Kid Galahad also defends his IBF featherweight belt against Kiko Martinez, who's chalked up a points win since being robbed blind against Zelfa Baffert back in February. That was on the undercard of Josh Warrington's KO loss to Mauricio Lara. People are moaning about this, but Kiko is still a credible contender for me. The one I think Galahad will comfortably outbox. And that's all from the boxing, really. The UFC returns with a fight night card at the Apex, headlined by former featherweight champion Max Bless Holloway, as he takes on the inventive, unpredictable, but sadly inactive Yair Rodriguez over 5 rounds. These two have identical physical attributes, but employ them in wildly different ways. Holloway's resume speaks for itself. 4 years as champ, could arguably still be champ after the Volkanovski rematch. I think he definitely won that fight. He's beaten Jose Aldo, Anthony Pettis, Brian Ortega, Calvin Kattar. He lost out to Poirier when he tried to become double champ at lightweight. He even tried to fight Khabib on short notice. He's a Don, man. And Yair Rodriguez, his highlight reel is next level. Check out his KO elbow of the Korean Zombie. It's immense, man. He also holds a win over Dan Hooker down at featherweight, but he hasn't fought in 2 years. But we'll see what happens. When he starts throwing those mad kicks, anything can happen. Anyone can get knocked out, man. And that's it.
And Flynn, you put something in the group earlier that Khamzat Chimaev may be stepping in last minute.
Last minute, not for next week. I think it's in a couple of weeks. So we were supposed to have our Birmingham zone, Leon Edwards, up against Jorge Masvidal. Jorge's pulled out. He says it's because of an undisclosed injury. But I don't know if you guys have seen it. Covington called him out in a press conference and said, pull out of that fight. All on you, John. Yeah, pull out of that fight. We'll fight next March, I think. We'll fight in the spring. Leon, he's always getting done over this way, Leon.
That's raving, man. Yeah, it's because he's from Brom, isn't it? It's because he's from Brom.
It's a Brummy boy. And even worse, for our Brummy is that Khamzat Chimaev is the man standing up to take him on.
They tried to do this to Leon Edwards already. They tried to do him dirty. Listen, Khamzat's the next guy. Everyone knows he's the next guy. Mm-hmm. Leon Edwards has been stringing together fights for the better part of 6 years, man. The only person he lost to was Kamaru Usman. They're going to fuck him out of a title shot because he's not marketable. Oh, this is slack, man.
I hate that.
This is fucking slack.
Can you imagine
slack,
how fuming
man.
You'd be? Yeah, he's been toiling away. Do you know what I mean? Like beating up these geezers for 6 years, and then he's going to get put against this absolute psychopath. Actual psychopath.
Khamzat will batter him, you know, as well. I don't even want him to take that.
I think
he
will. Yeah. I mean, I'd always go for the Brummy, but this guy is just something else.
I think Leon Edwards would have been, I would have slightly favoured him against Masvidal. I wouldn't favour either of them against Khamzat. I really wouldn't, man.
I agree with you 100%.
Oh, I feel sad again now. Fuck this.
But you know what? Awesome episode. I've loved this one. I've really enjoyed this.
It's been my favourite so far, I think, man.
Yeah, I concur completely.
And a large part of that is thanks to our man Nick over here.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much for coming on. I know it can be a bit weird, and it like obviously this is a bit of an unusual scenario, but you blended in wicked. You're your personal account, your opinions, your stories and everything. Impact, you're welcome back on anytime you want, man. Anytime.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure. Cheers.